We were 2 days away from closing Kogi. And what I told the team was, if we're going to go down, we're going to go down the Kogi way. And what we did was we just started giving food away for free. And everyone just started donating. I made a promise to everyone that every penny that came in, we would make sure that goes and serves a hot meal to someone.
Chef Roy Choi talking about the early days of the pandemic and how close he came to going out of business. I'll talk with him later this hour. First, though, California's indoor mask mandate is ending next Tuesday, but only for vaccinated Californians. People who are unvaccinated will still have to mask up. Here in LA, we'll have to keep wearing our masks inside for a bit longer because the county sets its own rules. California is still averaging nearly 30,000 new COVID cases a day. While still a lot, it's a 70% decrease compared to just 2 weeks ago. COVID deaths are going up, though, as deaths are a lagging indicator. Hospitalizations, though, are beginning to stabilize. Here to walk us through what all this means is Dr. Abrar Karan, epidemiologist at Stanford. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so we're seeing this dramatic decrease in the number of new daily COVID cases, and the test positivity rate is below 10%. But still, a lot of cases, far more than during the Delta summer surge. So what do you make of this decision to lift the indoor mask mandate for vaccinated people next week?
I think there's a lot of moving parts here. So as you mentioned, on the one hand, you've got test positivity, which is down below 10%. It was like above 20% during the kind of peak of Omicron. And the question that is on everybody's minds is what's going to happen when you start to pull back on certain mitigation measures like masks, when you still have a lot of infections in the community. And I'll give you a relative number. When I worked on the Massachusetts state response last year, when we had a really low number of cases, our test positivity percentage was less than 2%. Looking at California and LA County, that was similar as well when we've had lower incidence. So when you have a lot of disease still ongoing and you pull back on mitigation, the question is how much reversal will you see in cases? So that's one thing to consider and one thing that I've been thinking about.
Yeah, the test positivity rate, the 7-day average, I'm just looking at it now for LA County, is 8.39%. So nowhere near the 2%.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the, you know, one analogy would be, let's say you essentially have a large pile of dry wood and you start to throw matches into that. What's the chance that it's going to catch? Well, if you have, if you throw fewer matches in there, the chance is lower. But if you throw a lot of matches in there and you have a big pile, the chance it catches is higher. Same with infections. If you have a lot of infections in the community, you pull back on mitigation measures, what's the chance that you now start to have exponential spread again? Versus if you have way fewer infections in the community, such that if you pull back, the chance of an outbreak starting is much lower.
So you think it's premature to lift the mandate for vaccinated people?
I think that if we wait longer, a few weeks longer, our test positivity percentage will come down even more because we see that it is heading in that direction. So we'll get the benefit of a lot of people will have immunity from getting infected and from vaccinations, and we'll have a lower number of people. You know, there's no guarantee though. It could be that when we pull back on it now that cases still continue to go down because we've had so much spread. So it's really hard to predict which direction that'll go in.
Right, because there's so much community infection that that may act as a way to prevent even further community infection, even though we're only at 73% fully vaccinated here in California.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if you look at the state and you look at different counties, there's a lot of discrepancy. There always has been from the beginning in terms of vaccinations and in terms of boosters as well. And so you're dealing with local epidemics first. And that throughout the country is a big patchwork. If you look at a map of vaccinations by county in the country, it'll be all different colors.
By the way, when I said fully vaccinated, I meant two shots. But a lot of experts are now saying you're not fully vaccinated until you've had three shots. What do you think?
I think that's true. I think the data that we have for boosting people shows that there is efficacy of the boosters in terms of reducing infection, reducing the chance of severe disease, hospitalizations and whatnot. But we do know that, you know, if you've been infected, that also counts for something and your immune system has now seen the virus and can respond to it. And so if you're infected and you've been vaccinated as well, that also will give you good immunity.
Right. So what do you envision when this indoor mask mandate is lifted next week for vaccinated people? When it comes to going into stores, grocery stores or retail stores or things like that, how will, again, the people who work there have to handle that? Will they have to ask people for their vaccination status? Will they be doing that policing again?
I doubt that's going to happen. Enforcing this has always been tough from the beginning of the epidemic. Even early on when we were trying to check people at the airport when they were flying in, I never was asked for anything. Whereas if you go to another country, you're flying internationally. When I had colleagues who had gone to work in Global Health in Rwanda, for instance, and they were asked for all their information. They were called up afterwards. There was a lot more public health intervention going on than I've ever seen in the United States on that front. So I don't think it's going to be enforced. I think that a lot of people who have not been vaccinated and who have not really been interested in masking, and there's some overlap in that community, that will have people doing that. And, you know, many people have pointed to the fact that, well, even if no one's masked, you can still wear a better mask. You can still wear an N95, for instance, if you're immunocompromised or if you're working there. Sure, you can. But this has always been about a public health response, not just having people figure it out for themselves.
Well, speaking of, we were just told to upgrade to N95s just a few weeks ago. So does this also engender a little bit of confusion if we're told, okay, well, we can take our masks off, but then we should still be wearing these high quality masks in certain circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, it is confusing for people. And I think that the reality is, as an epidemiologist, as someone working on this, even before Omicron, I had been pushing for high filtration masks along with many other colleagues who work on this virus. And that's because the virus transmits the same way, by aerosols. And whether you have Omicron in there or Delta or some other variant, it's the same mode of transmission. And so yes, those high filtration masks will be important now. They'll be important for the next variant that comes up that's inevitable. You'd be hard pressed to find any expert saying that we will not have any more variants. Omicron will not be the last variant. And so those masks, I would say, keep those handy.
What about for kids? We saw just yesterday, New Jersey, Connecticut, Delaware, Oregon, all say they're going to end their school mask mandates. We're not doing that here in California yet. What do you think about that? Given the fact that in Europe, the CDC's European equivalent only recommends masks for students 12 and older because for various reasons. And I'm just wondering what your take is on students wearing masks, especially the little ones.
Yeah, I think that, you know, for those who have been, who start from a position of saying, we don't want kids wearing masks, they push for and ask for data to say, is there any data to support the benefit of masks for kids in terms of reducing infections? And you can play that the other way as well and saying, is there any data to say that having kids wearing masks is going to have significant harms to them? What I can say as an infectious disease doctor is that there's more and more data coming out that just getting infected alone is a problem. So there's a big data set from the VA that came out this week that said for patients that have had COVID, even that are mild cases, they have a significantly increased risk of cardiovascular disease sort of across the spectrum. And I think we're still learning about a lot of the long-term effects, right? It's only been a couple of years where we're relatively speaking in the very early stages of the pandemic, an epidemic, and the early stages of COVID as a disease. And so what this will mean if we let a lot of people get infected, including kids, it's really hard to say. So I do think we need to be careful. We always have to weigh the risks and benefits. And I would rather see kids not get infected, which means putting in measures to make classrooms safer, such as improving ventilation.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Abrar Karan, he's an infectious disease physician at Stanford. Coming up, California is pouring $3 billion into community schools as a way to keep kids in the public school system. We'll tell you what these schools are next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. What if a school wasn't just a place for students to learn how to read and do math, but a place where families who, let's say, have recently immigrated to the United States could receive legal help, or teenagers struggling with mental health could find a therapist, or a child could just see their doctor. That's the idea behind community schools, to serve the needs of both students and their families. And California has committed $3 billion to convert thousands of public schools into community schools over the next 7 years. Here to talk about this is Karen Hunter-Quartz. She's director of the UCLA Center for Community Schooling, which helps run a couple of existing community schools here in Los Angeles. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, one of your schools is in Koreatown. It's called the RFK UCLA Community School. It's a public school, an LAUSD school, but different. So what does it look like? How does it work?
Well, it's a school. We serve about 1,000 students from transitional kindergarten to 12th grade, and it feels like home. You know, students are known really well because we get to know families. We get to know their siblings. They're with us for 13 years, and we get to help them on their journey and know their families.
And what kind of services do you offer?
Well, we have a range of ways to extend learning beyond the school day, after school programs, summer programs. And we also have a really enriched curriculum. So part of being a community school is having a set of community teachers. So teachers that are really attuned, culturally competent. Most of our teachers are bilingual teachers of color, and they connect with the students in really powerful ways. So learning becomes more connected to their lives. They do social action projects. They have internships in the community. You know, so there's a lot of enrichment inside the school day. In terms of services outside, we have the UCLA Law School runs an immigrant family legal clinic on our campus because most of our families are immigrants. And that's a really helpful resource for understanding rights and providing representation, community education. We have arts programs through UCLA. We have a beautiful multi-generational after-school arts program that brings together families to make art. There's just a rich set of programs and services and opportunities that really round out students' education.
It sounds wonderful, but it also sounds expensive. Does it cost a lot more to run one of these schools than a regular public school?
Well, the cost is a complicated question because the idea behind community schools is they braid funding from a lot of different sources. So, you know, the UCLA contributions are also helping UCLA, right? So we're a site for learning for our students. And so it ends up being a win-win for partners that can advance their mission. You know, there's been cost-benefit analyses that show that every dollar invested in a community school comes back in a much higher rate. There's a lot of evidence that these are very successful models and approaches to schooling. So the cost issue, again, it's not as straightforward as dollars in and out.
But it is more expensive than running a traditional public school, right?
It takes more resources, but where the resources come from are more nuanced.
Right. So California, $3 billion investing in these schools, that's a lot of money. And as you say, there is evidence to show that this money is well spent. What is that evidence? Are the kids who go to these schools, are they higher achievers on, I don't know, standardized tests? Do they have higher graduation rates?
Yeah, all of the above. So there's a lot of evidence out there about the effectiveness of community schoolings. One of the biggest studies was done by the RAND Corporation of the New York City Initiative. And that study found positive impact on graduation, credit accumulation, on-time grade progression, attendance, and other indicators. At our own community schools, I can tell you we've seen an increase in a number of indicators. For example, 82% of our graduates enroll in college compared with 55% of students nationally who attend low-income, high-minority schools. We also, you know, we're a dual-language school. One of the important pieces of the community school approach is building on the strengths of your community, and our community speaks more than English, which is really an enormous asset. And we have graduated last year, 53% of our students with the California Seal of Biliteracy, which is much higher than the 13% statewide rate. We also have a high teacher retention rate, and that's a really important number, especially as we watch the teaching profession undergo such struggles in keeping teachers, particularly teachers of color. So these are places that provide a supportive workplace, resources for students, for teachers, and our experience is they've been very successful.
Well, speak about that, if you would, how the pandemic has shifted some of this, because as you mentioned, there is a crisis in terms of teachers and other school professionals leaving the profession and it being difficult to replace them. Right now at LAUSD, there's a problem even finding substitute teachers. So how will the state be able to roll out this very resource-intense initiative that would require more personnel on campus to carry out all of these initiatives when we're seeing such a decline in people entering the profession and people wanting to stay in the profession?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a very important challenge the state's facing. I can tell you that, you know, the teacher preparation is going to be crucial here, and not just preparing more teachers for the profession, but preparing more community teachers. So the approach that teachers take in these schools needs to attend to students' socio-emotional health, but also teachers, and thinking about how to create sustainable workplaces. So they're not running around doing everything, but there is a team. There's a solid support staff of people that are there to provide, you know, mental health services, therapy, any other kinds of resources. So these things don't just fall on teachers. So in some ways, right, it's a whole child, whole teacher initiative.
Right. And there have been calls to have a therapist on every school campus or at least a school nurse, and it's been hard to find them.
That's right. No, the staffing challenges are massive. And it's going to, I think that's why the community school movement is so promising, because it's saying it's not just going to be teachers that will solve this, right? We all have to come together. Our communities need so much to recover from this horrible pandemic.
So is now the time to have to roll out this initiative, do you think?
Absolutely. Oh, there couldn't be a more important time. I mean, the disparities we're seeing in our communities of color and the need for basic services and supports as children try to process what they've been through these last 2 years. It's an incredibly important time.
Well, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Karen Hunter Quartz is the director of the UCLA Center for Community Schooling. Coming up, Chef Roy Choi of Kogi fame explores what it means to run a restaurant that pays its workers a living wage.
I'm not going to give up my standards and my dignity and my integrity of what I believe in just to run a restaurant. I'm going to run a restaurant with all of those things.
Roy Choi is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for TV on the radio.
The crown has landed on my head.
Yes, queen, yes.
You're not a killer.
This is the way.
You have to be a killer.
There was an offer before me.
If you're trying to curse, you can't.
That's bullshit.
We have so many disasters bombarding us right now.
We're going to talk about Kogi, the food truck that inspired 1,000 food trucks both here in LA and across the country. Kogi's Korean barbecue tacos were an instant hit when the truck started roving around LA streets in 2008. And they earned Chef Roy Choi a place among the city's top culinary ranks. Well, since then, Roy Choi has launched several more trucks, a couple of brick and mortar restaurants, a catering business, a few TV shows, including a PBS series about social activism called Broken Bread. The show began its second season recently, and in it, Roy Choi tackles big issues such as the impact of the pandemic on restaurant workers and what the industry should do about it.
It's estimated that undocumented workers comprise 10% of all restaurant employees in the U.S., and as many as 40% in cities like L.A. and New York. When they lost their jobs, there was nothing to fall back on.
And Chef Roy Choi joins me now. Welcome.
Hey, Madeline. Look, Ma, I'm on Press Play. Man, this is so excited.
<Woo-hoo.
laughs> This is a big deal for me. I listen to you all the time.
You do? Oh, well, it's a big deal for me because I eat at your trucks all the time. So there you go.
Okay, there we go. This is a love fest here.
It is a love fest. All right, well, let's talk about what has happened to your trucks and your restaurant with this pandemic.
It hit us directly in the heart, you know. March 2020, when everything hit our world for all of us in every aspect of life, the restaurant industry got hit the hardest, you know. Our industry itself is already a very fragile industry economically. Most restaurants that you all eat at or frequent or may even look busy from the outside looking in, they're usually just a couple days away from being bankrupt, you know. So the model itself is very fragile. And what the pandemic did was it exposed everything. You know, you saw restaurants crumbling within the first week of shutdown.
Well, what about for you?
For us too. We were 2 days away from closing Kogi. Can you believe that?
Oh my God, really?
Because everyone was scared. And what I told the team was, if we're going to go down, we're going to go down the Kogi way. And what we did was we just started giving food away for free. I said, like, listen, man, you know, if this is inevitable, let's just do it the way that we started, you know, with free spirit and nothing to lose. And so we did that. We started feeding anyone who lost their jobs. We started doing pickups and drop-offs. We did drive-throughs in Whittier, all, you know, San Gabriel, South LA, everything. The Kogi fans, they came out in force on the internet. They asked us to set up a Venmo account and everyone just started donating. I made a promise to everyone that every penny that came in, we would make sure that goes and serves a hot meal to someone. What happened to Kogi is we lost 60% of our business overnight, because 60% of our business is catering. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with like KCRW might hire us for a party, or we do a lot of like television and movie sets, you know, like a big chunk of our life every day during the day was going to office complexes. Everyone stopped going to the office. So we lost everything overnight. And it was the donations that kept us alive.
That is such a great thing and really heartwarming. What about government aid? Did that help at all?
It took a while. We got a little bit for the Paycheck Protection Program, and that was enough. See, our goal was just to make sure that we didn't have to lay off anyone. And that was really it. And Kogi survived. And, you know, it gave me hope. And I saw a glimpse of like a world where, in a way, like the idea of money or profit doesn't exist. That we are all just in it together. And, you know, it felt very nature-like. Like a tree with a nut and a squirrel, you know, like it just felt like it's all supposed to fit together.
You talked to a young woman who is a Vietnamese chef. Yeah. She is committed to paying her workers a living wage. Like, I think it's $18 an hour, right? Something like that.
18 plus pool tips comes out to about 25.
That's a lot. And she admits that she doesn't know how she's going to make it sustainable. How can she?
That's in our first episode, The Future of Restaurants. And the restaurant's called Bea U in Silver Lake. And her name is Uen Lee. Who knows? You know, for a lot of us, you know, what the great thing about Broken Bread is that sometimes when you're swimming upstream and you're trying to do things like outside of the norm, you're trying to lead with your heart, you feel alone in the world sometimes. And the great thing about Broken Bread was that I realized I wasn't alone. There are certain things you feel in your gut, but your brain tells you that's impossible. And the brain is telling her that this is completely unsustainable. You know, the restaurant industry itself only has, especially a small to-go restaurant like hers, you only have about a 5% margin to begin with in profit. And so with that, what happens is people get exploited. And it's just a nature of this kind of old system that we live in. And so she's like, you know, screw that. I'm not going to give up my standards and my dignity and my integrity of what I believe in just to run a restaurant. I'm going to run a restaurant with all of those things. And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, you know, it's going to last as long as it's going to last.
Yeah.
She's paying people way above minimum wage. She's charging way below what she could for the food. She's making sure people have sick pay, vacation pay, benefits. She's trying to raise the boat for everybody. On paper, none of that adds up. But in life, it does add up, and she's thriving. What does that say about us all maybe taking a chance and looking at these old systems and saying they don't work anymore?
So maybe she's making up for it in volume, like she's just selling more?
The practical answer is making up for it in volume, using creative techniques and recipes, using a long form cooking, what we call slow cooking, so that you have better margins and you're using, you have no waste, things like that. But I want to say, and I don't know if this is the right place for it, Madeline, but I want to say that there's something beyond the tangible as well. Hmm. I believe in that stuff. You know, wow. I believe that if like everything on paper says it's not going to work, but you put all your heart into it, it's like public radio, man. This shouldn't work. You know what I'm saying? Like, it shouldn't work, but it does. And I feel like there's something that beyond ourselves in the universe, that if we put everything into it, that it's going to work.
Let's talk about the role of restaurants in gentrification. You address that in the series as well. Sure. And not frequently in the series. I guess I'm wondering, her restaurant, while small and committed to, you know, living wages and sustainable prices for people, is still part of a changing neighborhood that could be called a gentrifying neighborhood, Virgil Village, right?
Oh yeah, we focus on three areas really. You know, her restaurant, Virgil Village, we focus on Chinatown with My Story with Chego, and we focus on Leimert Park, which is at the heart of gentrification. But mm-hmm. as far as the village goes, where Bayou is at, that's like a case study for a lot of what happened in the neighborhood, like in Los Angeles with gentrification. You're talking about a working class neighborhood, a mostly Latino neighborhood, where one restaurant opened and caused a chain of events. And that restaurant was called Squirrel. Yeah. And it caused a chain of events that took a neighborhood, you know, that was low rent, that housed a lot of people that worked in the service industry or the blue collar industry. And all of a sudden it became Virgil Village. Everything changed. You know, people were being displaced, rents were going up. There was entitlement. I think where we are now, we can't claim ignorance anymore. Maybe there was a time when Squirrel opened that people who were going there could say, oh, you know, like, I'm just here to get whatever I'm here to get. I'm contributing to the neighborhood. But now I don't think we can claim that ignorance anymore.
So what do you do? I guess, what do you do as a consumer or a, you know, someone who wants to support local businesses? And it was a local business, or it is, I guess it still exists, but yet doesn't want to gentrify. Someone who wants to have a good meal. What do you do?
Well, part of it, I think, is rests on the shoulders of the owner. Like you see a new generation after Squirrel, like a Bea'u with Uen, she's making a difference. She's making sure she's understanding the demographics and the conditions of the neighborhood as she opens her restaurant. But the other thing as a consumer, and I think we get there in the Chinatown episode, at least we try to, is that when I speak of that we can't be ignorant anymore, I think that we have to create a surcharge or a shared profit by the establishment, and the prices have to be a little higher. We should all know when we're going to a place as a consumer that has maybe taken over or popped up in an area that is most likely a neighborhood of community of color or a marginalized neighborhood, and they're there because the rent is cheap, right? Mm-hmm. And so we as consumers have to be open to paying a surcharge that goes towards like a oversight committee fund that works as a mediary between development, growth, and also sustainability. So that would apply, if we could go into the past, that would apply everywhere from Bushwick, Brooklyn, all the way to Silver Lake. But now that we're in the present moving forward, I think that anything moving forward, we as a collective food community, as a culture community, as a seeking community of new things, that is something that is our responsibility, you know, moving forward. We can't just claim ignorance and say, well, you know, like, I only want to pay $4 for this. But you're choosing to go to this place knowing damn well where they're opening. So I think it's important that you should be able to pay $6 instead of $3 or $4. And then
where would that money go?
That money goes to a committee or like an oversight fund that is head by organizations that are fighting against gentrification. Because I'm not against growth either. I want to make that clear, because I'm also a business person, right? So I'm not against growth, but I am for tender and loving growth. And I think we need to be checked. This capitalist system, like, pulls out the animal in us. If you hear of a new place in town, you know, we flock to it, right? And yeah. The writers can't stop writing about it. The consumers can't stop wanting to get into it. And we lose all of our senses and all of our just righteousness of knowing what is right. And we just end up becoming very selfish as consumers and yeah. as people.
It's complicated though, because yeah. like I'm watching some of your episodes and I'll see a place that you highlight and yeah. it looks so delicious and I want to go there.
You want to go.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the restaurant owner would like my money. But at the same time, if many more of me goes to this other restaurant, then that starts perhaps a gentrification process that might in the long run not be healthy for the neighborhood. So it's complicated.
I do hear what you're saying, and you are right when it's an outsider coming in, but there's also a positive side to this, and there is an inspirational side. In Broken Bread, there's a whole new entrepreneur that's coming from the inside out, right? So in that case, we've evolved just a little bit to where now your support could actually be beneficial. So you're seeing that in episode 5 with Voodoo Vegan and Nature's Thirst Trap and Haroon Coffee, all in Leimert. You're seeing that in Boyle Heights, you know, with Machine and Mirpa Grill, you know, you're seeing that in Chinatown, Avenue 26. And so you're seeing a whole new wave of entrepreneurs that are coming from inside the neighborhood and not outside. So there is hope.
Yeah. So you mentioned Leimert Park. Let's talk about Englewood, another Black community. There's SoFi Stadium. Super Bowl is coming up. What's happening there when it comes to neighborhood restaurants possibly being bulldozed and the history being changed quickly?
Oh, it's happening right under your noses. It's happening as you and I speak right now.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not just Inglewood. It's like the volcano that happened in Tonga, and you get the waves here in Santa Monica. It reverberates all the way to Watts, to Linwood, Crenshaw, everywhere. People are getting displaced, especially in the projects that I represent over in the, that I'm a part of and family with in the Jordan Downs. You know, you're going through a whole development process where people are being pushed out. Mm-hmm. From the outside, it said, oh, well, this is government housing. These are buildings that were built in World War II. Like, don't you want something new? But what people don't realize is in a community like Watts, these are generations and generations of families that have history and stories and poetry built into the soil of that ground. And it's not as easy just saying, you know, just move to Victorville or just move to Lancaster.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about, you know, again, you know, life, and you're seeing it directly through Leimert and through Crenshaw. And what we try to show in that episode in Leimert is the unimaginable idea and threat of could Leimert not be a Black neighborhood in 10 to 15 years. It's almost absurd to even think of, right? It would be the same as saying, could Harlem not be a Black neighborhood, you know?
Well, that same conversation has been happening in Harlem.
Absolutely, right? And it's happening right now in Crenshaw because of the Metro Line and because of SoFi Stadium and because of everything that's happening with development and gentrification and the need for housing and the need for condos. It's a tough thing to grapple with, but our show is not as heavy as your show. I'm not as smart a host, so I use food as a lens to be able to bring things back to like a little bit of a kind of a touchy-feely moment where we're like, okay, we'll use a certain part of the show to identify the problem, but instead of getting into like debates about it or political angles, we try to say, okay, here's the problem. And you know what? Here are people on the ground that are just saying, no way. And we just hope that their stories inspire you. You know, the one thing that you'll see in Leimert is that there is a resilience and a strength and a power. Even the most powerful people are scared, you know, because they don't own any land. So everyone is at the mercy of whatever's going to happen with development. And that's something that we're addressing, and hopefully the people that we cover are doing something about. You know, we're showing young entrepreneurs trying to make a difference, trying to build legacy businesses.
It's so inspiring. It's just to see how hard people are fighting for this the ideals that they have. And it's just, it is really inspiring. And also it makes me really hungry watching the show.
Yeah, right.
You know, so
that's the whole idea of the show. And I'm glad it does make you hungry, because food is our Trojan horse. It is our weapon, our positive weapon to bring everyone in. If we're going to confront the inequalities of life, it would require a lot of us to take a deep, hard look in the mirror. And that's really tough. But if we do it over food, instead of taking a look in the mirror and taking the blame, over food, we can all put down our guard and say, you know what? This is silly. This is stupid. This is ridiculous. And we're all going to do something about it, because it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that millions and millions of kids are going without any access to any vitamins or nutrients in their food, that they're only eating preservatives and sugars and sodium and processed foods, not only in their choices outside of school, but also in their school.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, so it just seems, you know, like if you were to say that for your own family or children, for anyone that has the fortunate ability not to be within those systems, you know, you would never stand for it. And what we're trying to say is, if you don't stand for it for yourself, why would you stand for it for anyone else? Mm-hmm. And we're trying to, like Uyen said, just raise the boat for everyone. Just make it even. And then you can have success beyond that. But people shouldn't be living below human levels. No one should.
So do you advise that we go to these restaurants and patronize them and these places that you highlight in the show?
Absolutely.
We should be doing and not feel like we might be contributing to gentrification or anything like that, but that we should go in with a spirit of curiosity and compassion and a healthy appetite.
Absolutely. Because again, what we're showing in our show is a whole new wave of entrepreneurs from the inside out. So you shouldn't feel guilty about supporting Compton Community Garden, Haroon Coffee, Voodoo Vegan, Nature's Thirst Trap, Know Us Without You, Machine, Milpa Grill, Sarah's Market, Kernel of Truth Tortillas. I could do roll call all day with you. This is what we've all been working towards, is not the outside coming in, but the inside coming out.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for spotlighting these businesses and the issues. And thanks for your delicious food.
Thank you for your delicious content.
My pleasure. That is Chef Roy Choi, and Broken Bread airs Tuesdays at 8 o'clock on KCET, or you can watch it on demand anytime on the PBS app. Coming up, film critic Justin Chang joins us to talk about the Oscar nominations. Don't go anywhere. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Oscar nominations came out today.
Belfast.
Coda.
Don't Look Up.
Drive My Car.
Dune.
King Richard.
Licorice Pizza.
Nightmare Alley.
The Power of the Dog.
And West Side Story.
10 films up for Best Picture, including Netflix's The Power of the Dog, written and directed and produced by Jane Campion. It received more nominations than any other film, 12. Joining us to talk about this morning's nominations is Justin Chang, LA Times film critic. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, what are the big surprises?
Oh, the internet is aflame this morning over Lady Gaga's perceived snub for her really great performance in House of Gucci, but it was a great year for Best Actress. I think snub is a word that people debate a lot whether we should use it or not, but I think we can say Lady Gaga's omission was surprising, given that she had hit a lot of the precursor awards leading up to this morning's nominations. And likewise, Kristen Stewart, who had missed out on a lot, got in for her performance as Princess Diana in Spencer, which made me very happy because I think she's terrific in that movie.
Well, let's talk about the Best Picture nominations that we just heard. Belfast, Coda, Don't Look Up, Drive My Car, Dune, King Richard, Licorice Pizza, Nightmare Alley, The Power of the Dog, and West Side Story. So it seems like there's something in it there for everyone, right? Western, a musical.
That's a really great way to put it. I mean, a Western, a musical, a noir, Nightmare Alley, a shaggy 70s comedy in Licorice Pizza. Uh-huh. Yes, a Western in Power of the Dog, a science fiction epic in Dune, whose director, Denis Villeneuve, was expected to get a directing nomination and is probably the biggest omission from that category. So right. It was a competitive year. But I think that this very wide-ranging Best Picture category, which has 10 nominees for the first time in a while, it's usually, in the past few years, it's only been like 8 or 9. It's been a little arbitrary. There are a lot of throwbacks in here, like Nightmare Alley, West Side Story, and Dune, all of which are remakes or readaptations of a kind. And the single most exciting development, I think, in Best Picture and in other categories is the very strong performance of Drive My Car. I mean, this is mm-hmm. my favorite movie of the year. This is a 3-hour, very talky, leisurely paced drama from Japan. Not an obvious movie to get Academy recognition outside of international feature, but it was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director Ryusuke Hamaguchi, and Best Adapted Screenplay. And international feature, so it has the four. It basically has the four that Parasite received and uh-huh. Ultimately won. I mean, Parasite received more nominations, but it won those four a few years ago. And so I think we're seeing, this is a different Academy. This is a more international, and I think because it's a more international Academy, it's a more discerning Academy because they're watching more movies and they're realizing that America does not have a monopoly on great cinema, and in fact, never actually did.
So interesting. Well, let's then segue into Best International Feature nominations. Drive My Car, as you just mentioned, Flee from Denmark, which that's interesting to me because that's a documentary, but it's in the Best International Feature category.
It's also up for animation, too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's which is unprecedented. I think it's the first time a film has been nominated in those three categories.
And The Hand of God from Italy, mm-hmm. Lunana, A Yak in the Classroom, and The Worst Person in the World. Talk about these films and which ones you like, if not all of them.
Yeah, I can't speak to Lunana, A Yak in the Classroom. It's one of the many submitted films that I have not seen yet. You can't see everything, even as a critic. But I'm obviously very high on Drive My Car and also The Worst Person in the World, which this is Joachim Trier's wonderful film from Norway, also recognized in original screenplay. So again, a sign that, I mean, the screenplay branches have nominated non-English language films before, but it's becoming more of a trend than a surprise now, which I think is very heartening. Mm-hmm. Flee is a terrific documentary that tells a really harrowing story of escape and freedom. And The Hand of God is Italian director Paolo Sorrentino's probably his most moving film in a while. I like it quite a bit. It's interesting because it is the year's other semi-autobiographical movie by a director, the other one, of course, being Belfast, Kenneth mm-hmm. Branagh's film, which is also
nominated
by the Academy, yes, for Best Picture Director, and many other categories as well.
Well, let's talk about the director category. Do you think Jane Campion is the favorite?
I think she absolutely is. I think of the major categories, I feel like Jane Campion is the closest thing to put her name on the statuette now. And it's thrilling to see that. It's also thrilling to see her up against Steven Spielberg, 28 years or so after they went head to head when Jane Campion was up for The Piano and Steven Spielberg won for Schindler's List. So back in 1990, that was the 1993 year in film. And Jane Campion pulled off something remarkable. She became the first woman to repeat a Best Director nomination, to be nominated for a second time in this category. And I think coming a year after Chloe Zhao won Best Director for Nomadland, broken record, it's a different Academy, and I think it's a better uh-huh. Academy, a more discerning one. It's just The Power of the Dog, too, the fact that this movie, which is sort of like a really brooding psychological drama in Western drag, I think, but mm-hmm. it also could, or vice versa, maybe. The 12 nominations, more than Dune even, with 10, I think testifies just to the extraordinary strength of that movie. All four principal actors from that movie not just Benedict Cumberbatch and Cody Smith McPhee, who are widely expected to very, very have a very good shot at winning in their categories, Kirsten Dunst for supporting actress, and Jesse Plemons in best supporting actor, which is maybe the most surprising of the four. But when something gets in that you weren't expecting in as competitive a field as acting, it just shows how much support that movie has across the board.
We'll talk a little bit about the perennial criticism of the Oscars in that often they nominate films that the most Americans haven't seen. And I guess that would be especially true with Drive My Car.
Yeah, I'm of the mind that most Americans haven't seen the best movies, so I'm all for it. You know, I think, and, you know, years ago, the Academy was interested in bringing a best popular film category, you know, as if making $1 billion wasn't reward enough. And I suggested at the time, can we please bring in a best unpopular film category to recognize things that fly under the radar? And of course, I'm being facetious, but I think it's wonderful. I mean, people like to accuse a lot of people, especially film critics, I'm not impartial about this, of being pretentious and elitist for suggesting that, hey, you might want to look a little bit beyond the multiplex, and you might even want to look a little bit beyond the English language speaking films at the art house. I think that Best Picture should be even more representative of the entire spectrum of cinema. We should see more animated films getting nominated. We should see finally a documentary getting nominated. No documentary film, no nonfiction film has been nominated for Best Picture before. This year we had, you know, in the documentary feature category, you know, you have Summer of Soul, you have Ascension, Attica, Flea again, and Writing with Fire. It'd be great, I think, to recognize that, you know, Best Picture is, think outside the box when it comes to what the best film of the year is.
Well, let's talk about the acting and actress category. So yes, as we've already discussed, Lady Gaga snubbed. We have Jessica Chastain, Olivia Colman, Penelope Cruz, Nicole Kidman, and Kristen Stewart, you mentioned earlier, nominated. And who do you think is favored to win?
Up till now, a lot of people might have said people would have probably put the smart money on Lady Gaga, and she wasn't nominated.
Yes.
So it's hard to say, I think, you know, because people will be looking at who wins the Screen Actors Guild Award. And I believe that only Chastain, Colman, and Kidman are nominated for that. So I think a lot of people were thinking this would be Nicole Kidman's second Oscar win. The actors clearly like being the Ricardos. They nominated Javier Bardem and J.K. Simmons as well. But I don't think the movie was clearly embraced by other branches, so it's hard to say. Likewise, The Lost Daughter, which is Olivia Colman's film. They love Olivia Colman, and she could win her second, you know, just a few years after she won her first for The Favourite a few years ago. So I don't know, and I haven't given up on Kristen Stewart, who was sort of the de facto front runner all along until she missed out on a SAG nomination a few weeks ago. And so now has been seen as like a tarnished front runner. But I still think we're at the point, she got the nomination, which a lot of people were expecting her not to. She got that, anything could happen at this point. But you hear a lot about industry resistance to Spencer as a movie, which is ridiculous to me, because I think it's probably one of the most interesting biopics, if you even call it that, to come along. I mean, the Academy will throw Oscars at every mediocre biopic that comes down the pike, but throw them an interesting one and they don't know what to do with themselves.
All right, so getting to the leading actor category, Javier Bardem, you mentioned, Benedict Cumberbatch, Andrew Garfield in Tick, Tick, Boom, Will Smith in King Richard, Denzel Washington in The Tragedy of Macbeth, and another face-off between those two. I guess they faced off 20 years ago.
That is very true. And Will Smith was up for Ali, and Denzel won for Training Day. So that is the rematch that people were expecting. But I would say most observers would put this between actually Will Smith and Benedict Cumberbatch. Smith, I think, there's a lot of love for that performance. I mean, I love that performance as Richard Williams in King Richard. And he's been nominated before and didn't win. And so it's perceived as perhaps overdue. But Benedict Cumberbatch, I have to say, you know, the lead actor of the most nominated film this year. I think Cumberbatch really dominated the Critics Awards and a lot of the precursors as well, although we'll see, there's still things to come. But I think it really is down to those two, and I think it's going to be extremely close.
So that'll be fun to watch on March 27th on ABC. Who's hosting, by the way? Do we know?
Do we know yet? I don't think we know. But there will be a host, and it will be at the Kodak Theater in Hollywood, and I think all signs point to them trying to, you know, after last year's downscaled ceremony at Union Station, this is sort of a a resurgent, maybe not entirely post-COVID, but mid to late COVID resurgence, yes, for the Academy Awards and for Hollywood. So, and I hope they pull it off.
Yeah, me too. We need a little glamour back in our lives. All right, Justin, it was such a pleasure having you back on the show. Thanks for coming on today.
Anytime, Madeline. Thank you.
Justin Chang, film critic for the Los Angeles Times. All right, that does it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast. Listen whenever you want, over and over and over again if you want. KCRW.com/PressPlay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I will see you tomorrow.